opiate epidemic and improve care coordination for our community. Details available at 202-250-5668. That's the Urban Health Initiative 5th Annual Peer Summit, Saturday, October 11th from 2 to 6 p.m. at Anacostia Park.
WPFW streaming is temporarily down. Our team is working hard to restore it as quickly as possible. Thank you for your patience.
Hi, I'm Danny Glover, and you are tuned into WPFW Washington, your station for jazz and justice.
Welcome to On the Margin with E.F. Burt Miller. My guest today is Susanna M. Morris. Susanna M. Morris is an associate professor of literature, media, and communication at the Georgia Institute of Technology. She's also the author of Positive Obsession, The Life and Times of Octavia E. Butler. How are you doing this morning, Susanna?
I'm well. How are you?
Okay, we have a lot to talk about. Okay, one I want to begin with your book titled Positive Obsession. And this was an essay Octavia Butler published, I think, back in Essence magazine. At that time, it was called Why I Write. What did Butler mean by positive obsession?
So first of all, thank you for having me. I'm excited to chat with you. Butler meant that her desire to read and write and research was a feeling that she could not control or stop. And so that's why she labeled it an obsession. But it wasn't like she was, you know, out on the street doing drugs, right? So it wasn't a dangerous expression, obsession. It wasn't like she was compelled to, you know, rock climb with no gear, you know? Mm-hmm. It wasn't that kind of adrenaline rush. So she called it a positive obsession. But it, you know, completely shaped her life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, when you say that, let's look at your life. What drove you or motivated you to write this book about Octavia Butler? And what did you have to overcome?
Yeah, so I have been a professor since 2007 and frequently teach courses on Black women's literature and, you know, frequently, you know, teach Octavia Butler's works. And I always like to give my students a certain kind of scaffolding before we get into talking about a text or an author. And so, you know, I'd be reading interviews or, you know, articles about her. I've written a couple of articles about her, academic ones. And I just wanted to know more. I'm nosy. I'm a researcher. So I was like, right. Okay, so how did you come to this conclusion or why did you do this? And Butler was a pretty private person, right? Mm-hmm. When she passed, you know, she left behind this voluminous archive, and I wanted to get in there and learn more about her intellectual process. So that's what prompted me to write this book.
But it's a biography, you know, I mean, yeah. I can see you writing, you know, doing academic articles, you know, placing essays, but the biography seems like it's like, you know, all of a sudden you're a long distance runner.
Yes. And I'm not a historian. Oftentimes, biographers are historians. They're folks who are writing histories of places or people. And I'm a literary critic. I'm like, this is what this metaphor means.
Right.
Simile means, this is the imagery. And so I was most interested in her intellectual process. I wanted to know what books she read, why she read them, when she read them, how did she take her notes, who were the folks that she spoke with, what was her writing practice like? Those are the sort of questions that fueled me in many ways. Yeah.
You know, I've noticed some interesting things on the part of this new generation of biographers of African-American women. They seem, and I'll use you as an example, you seem that you're writing about a woman's life, but you're involved. You've started also writing about yourself in terms of what does this woman mean to me? And mm-hmm. So the biography is at times very personal. All of a sudden the I comes in there. You know, this is what I feel like. And mm-hmm. and talk about that. Is that something that you see? I talked with Alex Gums and she had Audre Lorde and I found that happening, you know. Looking at Imani Perry, you know, I'm just looking at this list of mm-hmm. wonderful mm-hmm. critics who now doing the heavy lifting, but at the same time placing themselves where it says, okay, there's a spiritual relationship between you and Octavia Butler.
Right. Yeah, I mean, there's definitely like a kind of sense of kindred spirits of sorts, you know, not necessarily in the way, I mean, Alexis and I are friends and we talk about, we've talked about our work and, you know, she would be talking about communing with Audre Lorde. And I'm like, I'm not communing with Octavia. That's not the kind of ancestor that she is. she's telling me to write, to get my butt in the seat and write, to get to the archive and look at the papers, you know. But I do think, like, all the folks that you mentioned, you know, Imani Perry and Alexis Pauline Gums and myself and others, I'm thinking like Tanisha Ford or Ashley Farmer.
And Valerie Boyd, who's deceased. But
rest in peace. You know, many of these folks we identify as Black feminist scholars. Mm-hmm. And a core tenet of Black feminism, of feminism more generally, is that the personal is political, right? So I say in the beginning of the book of Positive Obsession that this is one way to tell Octavia's story. There are many ways to tell it. This is how I'm choosing to tell it. And because I, you know, start the book with this experience I had when I was a young person in high school of first discovering her work and how it just changed the trajectory of my life. And mm-hmm. I could not write this book without telling that story. So it's not that I'm in like every page or every chapter, right, even necessarily. There are key moments where I'm like, okay, let me break the fourth wall and say, I'm here and I experienced this thing. So like in my chapter on the parable series, I sort of talk about it, situate myself politically and, you know, where I've been teaching this book. I've taught at many institutions and sort of my experience teaching the series and so on. So, yeah, a biographer doesn't necessarily have to do that, but I do think there's a particular kind of efficacy in being like, hey, I'm a person. Right. I'm taking a neutral stance. I don't believe in neutrality. This is my particular perspective in engaging her life.
Well, you know, there's a point in your book that's made me laugh. You said Octavia Butler encouraged writers to run away from home or to travel. And I said, I could see Suzanne Morris with her Kamala sneaks running away from home.
I'm there. Look, I'm more of an Adidas girl, but yes, you know, I'm there running away, maybe like how people used to have the hobo sticks where you have the stick with a kerchief at the end. Yeah. Like, no.
Well, let's talk about that. Did you feel that you needed to maybe go to some sort of retreat or something like that just to get away from and have that space?
I didn't have a retreat per se, but I was lucky enough to have two fellowships that helped to support the writing because, you know, I started working on this book in 2020. Right before the pandemic started, and for a good chunk of it, I was writing this book from my house. I wasn't going on campus. I'm a caregiver for my mom, and so, you know, she is immunocompromised. I have my own health challenges, so we were keeping it very locked down. Mm-hmm. And then eventually, as the world started opening up, I was able to work for a semester at Princeton University as an Anschutz fellow. And I taught a class, a Butler seminar, and I just had a lot of latitude and leeway to, you know, work on my writing. And then I also spent a semester at the University of Michigan in their Humanities Center. And I didn't teach any classes. All I did every week was work with other folks. So they were professors of all ranks and also folks, graduate students who were working on their dissertations. And every week somebody would offer up a piece of their manuscript and we would read and critique one another's work. And that was really helpful as well. So the combination of like students, like I'm working with these students and they're so sharp and incisive. And then the next semester being around all these folks who are at different points in their career. Some people are like, I've been a professor for 50 years. I'm like, okay. And then other folks are like, I'm in my 20s and I'm trying to figure out how to write this dissertation. And everyone had something of value to share. Mm-hmm. And so those were some of the places where I was able to really zero in. But there were no like retreats per se.
Right.
Although I'm not against that. I just did not experience that with this project.
Well, you know, you mentioned something in your book, which is very, very important. And it places Octavia Butler alongside her sister writers. You talk about Toni Cabin Barrett, Audre Lorde, June Jordan, others, how these women have to balance, you know, their lives, sometimes raising the children by themselves, mm-hmm. or in terms of Octavia Butler, you know, she had health issues. Talk about that.
Yeah. So throughout her life, you know, Octavia experienced a variety of health issues from, you know, dental issues to heart issues, you know, high blood pressure. She certainly suffered from depression at different points in her life. You know, she talked about that. So part of what this book attempts to do is to pull back the veil. And, you know, I don't really believe in putting writers on pedestals, because the only way that you have to go is down from a pedestal, mm-hmm. right? So really, you know, just highlighting the very mundane, regular human experiences that Octavia had, though she was a genius, to be clear. I'm mm-hmm. not arguing that she wasn't, but she was a genius that often didn't have health insurance. Mm-hmm. And so she was committed to writing these stories, you know, doing this research, but sometimes her body hurt because she spent years doing physical labor, you know, doing manual jobs. Towards the end of her life, when she was also suffering from a type of writer's block, she was dealing with high blood pressure and taking kind of a cocktail of medicines. And one medicine, and if you're on medicines, you know that this may be your experience, you take one thing and it causes a side effect.
So right, you get drowsy, thing. Right, you get sleepy.
Right. Right, exactly. So that was happening. I feel drowsy, or I'm having insomnia, or I have this incessant cough. Like, what's going on? Every time I try to rest, I'm, you know, so she just had these experiences that really affected her experience as a writer. There was no, like, I'm going to a room of my own with a lock and a key, and I have, like, you know, people taking care of my stuff. She had to do it herself, and it was often very difficult.
How much of what you just said feeds into Octavia Butler's development of her character? So there's a character's carry some of these semblances because of what she's going through personally?
Yeah. So I think, you know, there are many examples, but one I think that listeners will be perhaps most familiar with is in Kindred. So like Octavia, Dana worked as in temp jobs while she was pursuing her writing. And this is what Butler did in the beginning of her career. She would often also just have her characters kind of look like her, right? They wouldn't literally be her, but there's a number of characters who are kind of tall, full-bodied, sometimes short natural hair, you know, at some point in the journey. So, you know, characters that kind of look like this, Dana, Lauren Olamina, Alana from Survivor to a certain degree, though she's described as a mixed race woman. Like, there are these, like, kind of tall, regal, full-bodied, dark-skinned Black women who sometimes have experienced the, like, okay, a similar job or maybe a similar family experience, right? So Lauren is from a pretty similar area than, you know, Octavia's from, right? She sets many of her stories in Southern California, right? Or what was formerly Southern California, depending on the time period. So there is a lot of connection there.
Talk about you sort of alluded to it because of color. You know, you're dealing with an African-American woman who's tall, who's dark complexion. How much is that affecting, you know, her life?
Oh, it affected her life a lot. So Octavia was about 6 feet tall by the time she was in middle school, right? So, I mean, I recall being a tall girl. I'm 5'7". I'm not 6 feet tall, but being taller than all the boys and most of the girls and so on. But I was not 6 feet tall. So 6 feet tall is very tall, right? She talks about when she was, you know, a young girl, middle school, high school, going out with some of her friends, her girlfriends, and they, you know, someone in out in the public would be like, oh, is this your mother? Referring to her, right? Right. Which was extremely embarrassing, and also, you know, reflects the ways in which Black girls are often adultified. She didn't look like nobody's mother. You look at the pictures of her as a youth, it's like, this is a tall young person, you know, or the ways in which Black women, particularly dark-skinned Black women, can be masculinized, even when they themselves are not sort of saying, I'm embodying a type of masculinity, right? Because anybody can be masculine. Mm-hmm. It doesn't belong to a certain gender. But sometimes it's foisted on us in a particular kind of way. I'm thinking about the Serena Williams, you know, particularly when she started playing tennis and all of that. So,
you know, I'm glad you said this, because I won't mention the publication, but many years ago, I was an advisor to a publication, and we're sitting around in the talking about who's going to be on the cover of whatever. Mm-hmm. And they're like, oh, we're going to stick Maya Angelou on the cover because, you know, people have recognition. And I said, no, let's put Octavia Butler on the cover of the magazine, dark-skinned woman, you know. And the reason why I said that is because I remember when Essence magazine, the magazine for today's Black women, came out, and it took years for them to put a dark-skinned woman with a gap between her teeth on the front of the magazine, because they had these concepts of beauty that were projected onto the Black community.
Yes. Yes. And so she experienced that. She was born in 1947. She was a baby boomer. And yeah, she came of age during the, like, I'm Black and I'm Proud kind of era, Black power, civil rights movement, and so on. But as you mentioned, there are these deeply embedded, internalized aspects of white supremacy that we often have to decolonize our minds, you know, to get rid of. And so she for sure experienced that. You know, she talked about as a young person that kind of curtailing some of her dating and social aspects, like the way she looked. And then that matched with, she was extremely shy and very introverted. And there are oftentimes these stereotypes about how Black women act, like we're always sassy, we have an attitude, angry Black woman, that kind of thing. And she was a person with a full range of personality, like any other Black woman or person. But she was definitely not falling into whatever perceived notions of Black womanhood and sexuality.
You know, in writing your biography, Susanna Morris, you went through a lot of correspondence and notebooks and journals by Octavia Butler. Were the things in Butler's notebook that surprised you?
I think what was perhaps most surprising was how hard she was on herself. That was hard to read as a fan and a biographer. She was really exacting about her work. Which makes sense, she literally had a positive obsession. But, you know, she would have in her journals, she had journals for travel, journals for, you know, and in those journals, she would have lots of different things in one book. So she might have a shopping list, a budget, entry from the day, and then maybe a sample of writing. And the writing would be amazing. Right.
How organized are her archives?
Very organized.
And where's the location?
They're at the Huntington Library in San Marino, California. And it is a public library. You do have to apply, get a card, and you have to go through a process to be able to see the stuff. But you don't have to be a professor.
Is anything restricted by Octavia Butler?
There are some, I think maybe four or five boxes that are embargoed for the next couple of decades, right? I think maybe the earliest one, if I'm correct, is embargoed until 2047. And then there are ones that are embargoed.
Do you as a detective biographer wonder what's in those boxes or have an idea?
I wonder, I don't know what's in them, but I suspect what I know about archives is that oftentimes when people embargo things, it's because there is maybe material in there that could be inflammatory or perhaps embarrassing to folks who are still alive. Right. So hopefully by 2047, don't nobody care. Or by 2057, it's like, I've gone to the great beyond. Who cares? You know, so I just presume it because that is generally the case. That is maybe some secrets or, you know, who knows? Octavia did not live a particularly scandalous life. She lived a life of the mind. You know, she was close to her family. She had a good, you know, cadre of friends and so on. But everybody has their stuff that maybe they don't want people to know about in the same way. I mean, she voluntarily offered up her archive. I mean, she was asked by the Huntington and she agreed, right? And she gave them everything, but with particular caveats, which is very common.
So we pick up your book and we know that you're introduced to Octavia Butler when you're in high school, you know, and that's not that. Did you discuss her work with some schoolmates and stuff like that? You know, we like a little book club going on of people who've been back in the room reading science fiction.
Yeah, no, I didn't. I read my science fiction and fantasy alone. People knew,
I like how you say that, alone.
Alone. people thought it was weird. Like, why are you reading? This was before, you know, Harry Potter, as problematic as the series is. It was before, you know, all Twilight and sort of the mainstreaming in some ways, the Hunger Games, all that kind of stuff. And so I was a teenager in the 1990s and kind of a girl from Fort Lauderdale like myself reading these thick science fiction and fantasy books with elves and whatever on the front. Folks were like, that girl's nice, but she's weird. So no, I did not talk about it with my friend, but they could see I was doing it, you know. Right. It wasn't until I got older and got to college and beyond, it was like I found other people that were also into the stuff.
Well, you know, you had a very nice review in the New York Times October 5th by Dana Williams, who just put out a new book on Tony Tony at Random, mm-hmm. Which is very good. Mm-hmm. In that review, Dana talks about you interviewed a number of people, and I was wondering how those interviews went. Who did you want to interview that you didn't receive an interview with? And then also, what has happened to me if you recorded those interviews? Where are you depositing those interviews?
Oh, that's a good question. I recorded them, you know, over Teams. They're on my computer. They're in the cloud. No one has asked me anything about saving them, but they are saved. I mostly talk to writers who knew her, or writers who are connected to, like, her work today. So, for example, I interviewed both adapters for the graphic novel series. So I spoke to John Jennings, who's the illustrator for, you know, all three books, and just talked about his experience working on it, why he made particular choices that he did, and so on. You know, I spoke with Cherie Renee Thomas, who's such a significant writer and editor, you know, who edited
Dark Matter,
yeah, both volumes, and, you know, worked with Octavia and so on. So those were the people that
did
I
you deal with, the married couple, Barnes
and Reeve do, yeah, and Stephen Barnes. I did not talk with them, but I spoke with many folks, and I really got to talk to everyone that, for the most part, I mean, some people were busy. It was the pandemic. There were lots of things, but I also just, there's so much material in the archive.
Mm. Let me ask you this question in terms of, it has a lot to do with I call it the big band of scholars and critics. Do you, did you look at critical articles? Has there been a lot of critical articles about Octavia Butler, like, say, in Calhoun Magazine or journals overseas? I mean, does she have this international presence?
There's absolutely, mostly American, but certainly international criticism, for sure. And that's really where I started, because I am a, you know, professional scholar, right, and I have published two for sure, mm-hmm, articles on Butler over the years, and also recently last year co-edited a special issue of the Black Scholar with my colleague Michelle Wright, and really focusing on emerging scholars. And so they wrote about Octavia and you know, Nnedi Okorafor and different folks. So there's a, I would say, cottage industry, as there is about, you know, many Black women writers who emerged from this kind of 1970s literary renaissance. So I started out as a Morrisonian. So I'm so excited about Dana's book and all the love that it's received, because it's a really wonderful text and very necessary, you know. So
if I was a young African American woman, and I'm down at the Georgia Institute of Technology, and you're my mentor, are there, and I'm interested in Octavia Butler, are there things that you would say, look, I did this biography, but there's a lot of material on Octavia Butler that needs to be examined. What would you recommend some of the things that a young scholar of interest in Octavia Butler should pursue?
Oh, there's so many different things. I think in terms of biographies, I would love to read a biography that is about her travels, because she wrote about her travels so explicitly and meticulously throughout her journals. If there's someone, and I had a young person in my last Butler seminar that I taught last spring, who was real, she was a biology major, and she wanted to look at how Butler talked about plants. Mm-hmm. You know, and so there's a lot of discussion both in the works, but also across her archive, where she's noting, this is what's in bloom in my neighborhood during.
That sounds like Alexis Gumm dealing with Audre Lorde. Is this all of a sudden, yeah, it's like, you know, where African American women were throwing rocks, you know, women were analyzing the rocks.
I mean, we're really talking about polymaths here who are just well versed in so many different things. And so Octavia was interested in sociobiology, anthropology. She was interested in biology, botany.
What's the challenge for you now as a biographer? Do you have to pursue all of those, at least have a knowledge? I mean, you're writing a biography of this person, and this person has all these different interests. Do you, like, say, okay, let me spread my map and make sure I go down these roads to make sure that when I put my biography together, it does talk about her interest in botany, it does interest in her travel?
Mm-hmm. I mean, to a certain degree, but I think as a writer, you have to make a choice. Mm-hmm. What is my perspective? What am I really focusing on? Because again, there there could be so many different biographies or critical assessments of her work. And there already are many, many, many critical assessments of her work. But I decided I'm looking at the intellectual trajectory. I'm looking at how she researched things. So I mentioned, yes, she's noting these things. She's taking notes, and I kind of leave it there. And the next person can pick that up.
Right. Well, I'm going to go back to something you said, and I want to bring in another person who's deceased, but very important. I mean, I remember when I used to talk to Claudia Tate a lot, and she had a book that came out in 1985, Black Women Writers at Work, with these interviews. But she also said that if you're a scholar, you can't just say, because somebody said something in the interview, you got to take it at face value. Because sometimes people, they lie.
Misremember.
Or misremember. And did you find that, after reviewing, interviewing people, and based on your own research, you say, this is not actually right. Or I think they have a misunderstanding of Octavia Butler.
I didn't really necessarily encounter misunderstandings. I think that she has, even though there have been any number of critical assessments, and there has been a middle grades biography, there's been a literary biography of her, there's an artist companion that Lionel George did, like there's works on her, but there's still not enough, right? So we're still excavating. A thing that I thought was interesting is that in many scholarly works, I see people talking about 1976 as the year that she went off and went to DC and, or the Eastern Shore of Maryland and was preparing for Kindred. And she was working on Kindred in 1976, but she took that trip in 1977. That's a minor detail, but I thought that was interesting. She did take a trip in 1976, and it was across the United States on a Greyhound going from city to city, because she had not really traveled outside of going to the Clarion workshop in Pennsylvania. So that was important to her. That she was able to travel alone, right, as a person who didn't have a whole lot of money. And then the next year she went on another travel, right? So that was something that I thought, people don't know that.
Right.
You have to get into the archive.
Right. In doing your book, Positive Obsession, did you do a lot of traveling with certain collections? You say, I've got to go to Schoenberg. I got to go to places like that, Moreland Spingarn and Howard. Did you have to?
Yeah, I went to a few places, but mostly her stuff is in the Huntington. Mm-hmm. And then when I these days, you can get almost anything online. So, there was like one piece from the Schoenberg. I'm like, okay, I can request that, so you don't actually, although I love going to the Schoenberg, but you don't necessarily have to be there. So that has democratized research in really important ways.
Mm-hmm. When you say that, I'm always concerned about, I'm looking at historically Black colleges. Sometimes, we lag behind in terms of digitalizing things. We have the material, but unless you actually come in, you can't actually.
Yeah. Yeah, and I experienced that too. So I went to look at Tony Cade Bambara's archive because they were friends, Tony Cade and Octavia Butler. And I live in Atlanta, so I hopped right on over to Spelman, where I taught for a very brief period in the early 2000s. And I went over and spoke with the wonderful archivist, Holly Smith, and, was able to get into Tony Cade's paper.
So you're saying you're one of these Janetta Cole people?
I'm a graduate of Mount Holyoke College, but I did teach at Spelman for 1 year, and it was a really wonderful experience. So I was, happy to be able to hop over there. But yeah, the stuff is not necessarily digitized in the ways that some of Octavia's work is digitized at the Huntington, or at all the works of the Schoenberg, or so on, because it's Holly.
Right. Okay, we're gonna take a little break. This has been wonderful. I'm talking this morning to Susanna M. Morris. She is a professor of literature, media, and communication at Georgia Institute of Technology. We're talking about her new book, Positive Obsession: The Life and Times of Octavia E. Butler. My name is E. Ethelbert Miller. The station's WPFW, 89.3 FM.
Is your social justice calendar for the week of October 6th, 2025. Thursday, October 9th at 10 a.m., there will be a luncheon for blind and low vision people hosted by the National Federation of the Blind of the D.C. Seniors Division at the Busboys and Poets Brookland location on 625 Monroe Street, Northeast Washington, D.C. For more info, visit busboysandpoets.com. On Friday, October 10th, from 6 to 8 p.m., Off the Mall Tours and Rainbow History Project are offering an intersectional look at LGBTQ History Month to highlight the lives of Black Broadway legends throughout history with the Queer Black Broadway Walking Tour at the Howard Theater, 620 T Street, Northwest Washington, D.C. For more info, visit eventbrite.com. On Saturday and Sunday, October 11th and 12th at 9 a.m., there will be a Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass tour hosted by Wisdom Walkers, Inc., located at the Harriet Tubman Underground Railroad Museum on 4068 Golden Hill Road, Church Creek, Maryland. For more info and to register, visit wisdomwalkers.org. WPFW's Social Justice Calendar connects you to grassroots activism in the DMV. Submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of the event. This is due by Thursday at 5 p.m., at least 1 week in advance of your event. WPFW's Social Justice Calendar helps build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Okay, we're back on the margin with my guest, Susanna Morris, and we're talking about her book, Possessed: Positive Obsession, The Life and Times of Octavia E. Butler. Susanna, you have an Octavia E. Butler chronology at the beginning of your book, and I would like you to comment on three things that happened to her. Sure. One, 1969, her meeting Harlan Ellison. Two, 1970, attended the Summer Clarion Science Fiction Workshop. And three, 1995, when she received the MacArthur Foundation Award. Just take us through those three highlights of her life.
So meeting Harlan Ellison was really pivotal for her. He became a really important cheerleader in her life and mentor, someone who helped shape her writing. She had, you know, in high school and in college, she went to Pasadena City College, which is a junior college in Southern California. She was encountering folks who did not know what to do with her work as a science fiction writer, did not know what to do with her work just as a Black woman who would coming in, you know, writing quote unquote strange fiction, and folks would accuse her of plagiarizing things. You know, you couldn't have possibly written this.
Sounds like August Wilson.
Right. Or very much, this is weird and strange and I don't understand this. Can you write something normal, basically? And so Harlan Ellison, you know, had already had a storied career as a writer and an editor. He was a volatile person. He was sort of hard to work with. Yeah. They had, you know, an up and down relationship in terms of being mentor, mentee, and also mm-hmm. friends. But she really credits him as being significant in her life. And likewise, when she was able to go to the Clarion Writers Workshop in 1970, she worked with Ellison again. She met Samuel Delaney and other folks. She met folks like Vonda McIntyre, who would become a really good friend over the years. And she found that to really be the incubator for her work, right? She did not get a bachelor's degree. She got an associate's in history, which she used very well, right? Mm-hmm. It was the Clarion Writers Workshop that really helped to catalyze her career as a writer. Not so much in terms of getting a bunch of things published. She published two short stories from that time, and then there was a 5-year drought in terms of getting anything published. She was writing.
When you go back, and this goes into connect what we were talking about her paper, do you see people commenting on the work that she had at that time that she was workshopping?
I didn't so much focus on that, but I was really focusing on how she felt about the experience.
I see.
And so she felt like she was being put through the ringer. It was so difficult. She called herself a slow writer. And so she's constantly, you know, for the weeks that she's there, you know, having to produce all of this work and getting critiques and having to read other people's work. It was just like a boot camp.
Mm. Well, let me ask you this, because you were talking about this. If you look at what's happening, people that she's meeting, like Ellison and also Delaney, is there a body of correspondence that she writes letters back and forth to those individuals?
To Ellison, for sure. She mm-hmm. wasn't as close with Samuel Delaney. They were more colleagues as the years went on. But and during that time period, she did take a course with him. Mm-hmm. But they didn't develop like a close friendship at
correspondence
that
type of thing.
No. And then in 1995, she wins the MacArthur, mm-hmm. and it is $295,000 of unrestricted funds paid out over the course of 5 years. And, you know, finances had been an issue for her. Anybody who knows a working writer, you don't write because you think you're going to get rich. You write because you love the art, right? And so that really shifted her life because money had been such a huge concern. It remained a concern even when she had money, right? She couldn't kind of shake the worry that she'd lived with for all of her life.
But what about the other thing that comes with the MacArthur, that's, quote, the genius award? Did that affect her?
So there's a lovely interview that she has with Charlie Rose. Folks can watch it on YouTube. And he's like, the genius award, the genius award. And she just is like, Charlie, that's not what it's called. You know, she was a fairly humble person. It's called this. It's, you know, I'm not calling myself a genius. That's a bit much. You know, she was clearly a genius, but she wasn't inviting people to call her that. But, you know, it's the thing about the MacArthur is that you cannot apply for it. It is something that folks have to recommend you for, and you don't necessarily get it the first time you're recommended, right? And those of us who've written recommendation letters for folks for MacArthur's, you know that you might write a letter for somebody and they not get a MacArthur until 5 years later. And they just put your little letter on file and then they add to it and then they look at what the scope of this person's work is, right? It's really significant that she's the first science fiction writer to win a MacArthur, not the first woman science fiction writer, first science fiction writer, period, to win it. So that also opened up the field in a particular kind of way.
You write in your book, Susannah Morris, that you considered Butler one of the foremost intellectuals of the 20th century. That's a big statement there. I'm going to put you on the stand. When we look at her books, what are the major issues that she's examining, and why do you elevate her to this important as an intellectual thinker?
I think that there's so many themes that are significant, but one that I would focus on for today is, especially in light of all the news that we're hearing about a hopeful ceasefire, right, for, you know, Palestinians, is this idea of the human contradiction. It's a term that she comes up with in the Xenogenesis trilogy, also known as Lilith's Brood. And in it, the Oankali, the aliens that come and sort of see human beings like, y'all are destructive as hell. Why should you be able to live on your own? Clearly you need, you know, to be on a leash in some ways. They note that human beings have a contradictory impulse, that we're extremely intelligent and we're resourceful and we're very hierarchical. And that this idea of hierarchy is oftentimes at service, or rather our intelligence is in service to this idea of hierarchy, but the hierarchies that we create don't make sense. They're arbitrary, right? I live here, you live there, you speak this language, you look like this, you worship this God, I don't like you, you're inferior to me. And we create whole social systems based on these very arbitrary things that actually don't matter. They're not evidence of our morality or character or ability or anything like that. And that we therefore are a self-destructive adolescent species. And I think that notion, even though it's articulated in that very specific kind of way in that series, shows up in almost every book. So we're really smart, but we're stupid at the same time, because why are we focusing on these things that don't really matter? We can create any kind of world we want to, but we've created this world. It doesn't have to be this
world. When we look at this world, I was just curious as to how much reading and studying did Octavia Butler have in terms of when we look at socialism and Marxism, because some of her work does seem to be a critique of capitalism. I'm just wondering whether she was grounding herself in Marxist theory.
I don't know that she would say grounding herself in Marxist theory, but she was familiar with it. She read about it. I don't know that she would call herself anti-capitalist per se, but she had critiques of capitalism for sure, identified as a Black feminist thinker. There's an interesting moment, I don't really write much about it, but I think about it sometimes, where I think I just mentioned, she goes to see Angela Davis at a lecture. And so in the early 1980s, she goes to see Angela Davis and she's talking about, you know, capitalism and so on. And in, you know, her notes, she's writing down what Professor Davis is saying. And she's also critiquing. She's like, well, actually, I think that her notion of capitalism here is not quite. And I think it does this and so on. So she was someone, it was hard for her to be like, I fall into this camp, because she had critiques of everything. So, for example, with Black Power, she was like, yep, I absolutely, this sounds good. And also the massage noir of it all. I can't get behind that, or, you know, these kinds of things. So she was never like just one thing. So she had huge critiques of capitalism, but she was like, oh, these are the benefits of it in some ways too, right?
Let's look at this closely, this label of Black feminists, because if we look at, we know that became problematic at a particular period in time. And I think when we look at it, you could probably say, okay, here's Barbara Smith, here's Audre Lorde, here's June Jordan. There's different interpretations of feminists. How would you find where you would place Octavia Butler? Was she one of the, you know, I'm looking at her in relation to, say, Toni Capron Barrett, other people, Fran Beal or someone like that. Where does she appear within Black feminist thought?
Yeah, I mean, she is in conversation. These are her peers, right? Mm-hmm. And Toni Kate is a friend, right? The ultimate cultural worker.
Right. What about Bell Hooks? Did she interact with Bell Hooks?
They knew of each other, but they were not close friends or anything like that. But Octavia was familiar with all the folks, the Alice Walker and the womenism. She did a review of In Search of Our Mother's Gardens for the Washington Post. Like, she was very much in dialogue with folks. And again, identified as a feminist when it was not cool. I don't know that it's ever cool to identify as a feminist. But so she was very much in, again, this idea of arbitrary hierarchy, right? She did not believe in gender essentialism. She was not anti-Black man, right? She was not anti-anybody. But this idea that women are inferior because of sex or gender, when these are social constructs, was a thing that she found irksome, right?
Well, let's talk to you. Let's focus on you, Susanna Mars, because you define yourself as a Black feminist. How has it changed in terms of, you know, I mean, this is 2025. This is not like 1975. So what have you seen an increase in terms of certain issues that are being addressed? Are there books that have come up that say provide a more clear direction of what Black feminism is?
There's tons of stuff. The thing is,
I like how you say there's tons of stuff.
You know, and obviously I'm biased because I'm in the community. But I'm thinking about works by, there's so many examples. So an example from the past, right? Recent past, I would say, you know, the Words of Fire, Beverly Guy Sheftall. Beverly Guy Sheftall, as a mentor to so many of us in the Black feminist communities, you know, the Bell Hooks Institute, there's so many examples. And then there are, you know, those of us from my generation, the sort of Gen X, elder millennials, you know, I'm a part of the Crunk Feminist Collective, and we fashioned ourselves after the Combahee River Collective. So we've been around for 15 years.
What African-American male intellectuals you would consider Black feminists?
This is the thing. I don't think that most of the men that call themselves, most of the men that move in feminist ways don't always call themselves feminists, right? And I'm not super interested in labels. It's my label.
Right.
But are you doing the work? So I would say like a Mark Lamont Hill, right? Mm-hmm. And his work, and especially the way that he writes very academic work. You know, he's a professor, but he's also on like podcasts with Joe Budden and just doing regular stuff, right? And inserting himself, you know, being like, you know, on VH1 with the Basketball Wives and talking about stuff. Like, he's very much ecumenical and always kind of able to speak to like in lots of different registers and so on.
You really might ask that question. You really might ask that question is because I was looking at how you can measure the impact of a revolutionary movement on the people who might have been opposed to it. And I know that when we talked about, you know, going back to Black feminists, people were against it and men were going. And so I was looking at the growth of, you know, these intellectual Black men. Yeah, I like how you say
This is an ongoing issue, the manosphere, you know, like there, the issues around gender in Black communities is still very fraught in many ways. We're still living in the aftermath of the Moynihan Report, and not just Black men. Black women might be moving in feminist ways or having, you know, feminist ideologies in their lives, but they don't necessarily want to use the term, which, again, I don't have a problem with. Womanist, feminist, nothingist, whatever you want to call yourself. But there's still this concern, like, our brother's going to be okay if I believe in this thing. Mm. And I'm like, that's the least.
Well, let me ask you this. When I raise these points, to me, it's like, okay, this is what's going on in the community. But what about you who you're in the academy? You know, do you see a struggle in terms of what you have to teach? We're going through a period right now in terms of the last eight, nine months that people, if you have a certain word or whatever, you can't teach that. I mean, and you're in the South.
I am. Yeah, I mean, I see it happening all across the country. I have been very blessed to be supported in my program. But the general tone and tenor is that, you know, folks have been on watch lists. Mm-hmm. Folks have been identified as dangerous or as doing work that is literally illegal. You know, just a few years ago, there was a whole crop of folks doing DEI-focused programming and so on, not necessarily academics, but folks who work at academic institutions, and those jobs have been eliminated or absorbed and so on. So it's a really harrowing time mm-hmm. to be working at a college or university.
Have any of Octavia Butler's books showed up on the censorship list? And if so, yeah. For why?
Explicit violence, sex, all those things. Kindred, I mean, pretty much every book, right? These are books that have graphic depictions of violence, of sex. Fledgling has like very strange age gap stuff happening. I mean, but really, honestly, the banning is because she's talking about race and gender in really provocative ways. And there is this, you know, idea that we need to shield children from these things while we live in a world that is racist and sexist. And all,
well, let's go back to what you said, and you were introduced to Octavia Butler when you were in high school. Mm-hmm. And that's a key point. What if, for example, those books by Octavia Butler were not available to you at that particular time? Would you, I mean, look at how did that book change your life?
Well, I had not been reading books by Black folk in school. I mm-hmm. was a voracious reader, and I read many books by Black people on my own, right? Encouraged by my mother, like, go to the library every week.
But that's a good point. But what if the librarian is all of a sudden the books they can't put on the shelf?
That's the thing. And I'm from Florida, where some of the worst book banning is coming from, right? And so I just think about the fact that I graduated from high school in 1998, and somebody who's graduating in 2026 mm-hmm. has less access to what I had almost 30 years ago. That's wild. You know, we have this notion of progress and it's forever going forward, but we know if we look at history right. that it's not that simple, right? And we're at a time of deep regression.
Sounds like we need another reconstruction.
When that works.
You know, you claim, Susanna Morris, in your book, that Octavia Butler cleared a path for literary revolution. What did you mean by that?
Yes. So the ways that she sort of opened up the field of science fiction and fantasy, right, that was for many years just her, Samuel R. Delaney, and Stephen Barnes, right? Along with them, she cleared this pathway, the fact that she's connecting with her fellow Black women writers, you know, like your Alice Walkers and your Toni Morrisons and your Toni Cades and all of that. She is a part of this path clearing, but she did it in her own unique way. She is the first that we know of Black woman to primarily publish in science fiction and fantasy. And she's the only one we know who's done that, who she was Black from the beginning. There's mm-hmm. no like, oh, we don't know. I mean, her picture wasn't always on the books. And sometimes they put white folk on the covers where it did not make sense. Dawn is a great example of that, or Pattern Master. But, you know, she was always who she was. Her picture was in the newspaper. She went to cons. She's like, here I am. I'm Black. I'm writing these things. And she was a possibility model, even though that was never necessarily her intention. She was like, I have to do this. This is my obsession. So that's what I mean about her clearing that path.
Mm-hmm. You know, as we move towards the end of our show, I want you to talk about two books and sort of invite our listeners into Octavia Butler's world. You write in a book about how Kindred, which came out in 1979, is usually a reader's gateway into Octavia's work. So I wanted you to talk about that a little more and why it is a gateway. If, for example, I never heard of Octavia Butler, I'm listening to you today, what should I expect in terms of that book? And then the other one I want you to talk about, which gets a lot of reference to, is Parable of the Sower in 1993.
Yeah. So, Kindred is a fantasy. She called it a grim fantasy because there's no science in it. Mm-hmm. And for folks who are intimidated by speculative fiction, by science fiction, fantasy, horror, etc., it is a good gateway because there's no, like, this is how the time machine works. And this is, you know, sometimes that is off-putting to a reader. It's hard for them to suspend their disbelief. They're too caught up in the mechanisms. And that's not what mm-hmm. that book is about. That book is about getting folks to feel what it would be like to be an enslaved person and how terrifying that would have been, right? And how strong those people were. That's really the, I mean, there are many points to it, but that's one of the main things that she wants us to feel. That's not dissimilar from reading Margaret Walker's Jubilee or Toni Morrison's Beloved. You're going to get into the interior life of these folks and what they experience. So it's not simply about the spectacular violence. It's like, what does it mean to get up every day and not own your body? Mm-hmm. And to have these curious relationships with the other enslaved people, with the white folk, with the, like, with the land. What does that mean? So it is a historical novel. If you mm-hmm. took out the time travel elements, it would just be a really wonderful historical novel. So that connects mm-hmm. with people. It's sort of like palatable in that way, even though it's a very hard novel to read mm-hmm. because it's about slavery.
Well, let me mention something for our listeners, because you mentioned this in your book, Positive Obsession. Octavia Butler does a lot of that research coming to Maryland and D.C., you know, and because of Harriet Tubman and Frederick mm-hmm. Douglass. So people in this area, our listeners should really get into this book because this is the landscape that she was using.
Yeah. And she didn't just like use her imagination. She did that, but she spent a lot of time in the library in Los Angeles. She had her own collection of books that she looked at. She talked with people in her family who were around in the late 19th century, early 20th century. So after slavery, but folks who would have had like, oh, my grandmother was an enslaved right. person, that kind of thing. Right. And then she literally went to archives. So it's very historically grounded. It just has this one speculative element in that there's time travel, okay. right?
Okay. And so, as we go, we're running out of time. Talk about Parable of the Sower.
Yes. With Parable of the Sower, it's set in 2024. July 20th, 2024 is when it opens. It's an epistolary novel, so it's a bunch of diary entries. And so again, it's not a novel, it's of the near future because it was published in 1993. The things that happen in that novel are unfortunately the things that are happening now. But when they were published, they were things that could happen. It was a cautionary tale. So we could have a white nationalist president. We could have a fascist regime. We could have wildfires ravaging the nation. We could have dirty water and unclean air and all these kinds of things. And how would a young person navigate living, growing up, you know, a Gen Zer, how would they navigate that? Well, maybe they create their own religion so that they can figure out how to move through this world that is so different from what their parents experience. So again, if you're someone who struggles with the suspension of disbelief, we in it. It's almost too present. So,
and you know, I want to make reference in terms of, we come to the end of our program, in Dark Matter, Sheree Thomas's book, the last entry is by Octavia Butler, the monophone response. And she writes about, perhaps someday we will have truly alien company. Perhaps we will eventually communicate with other life elsewhere in the universe, or at least become aware of other life, distant but real, existing with or without our belief, with or without our permission. Let me ask you, I mean, I tell people I'm waiting for the Great Pumpkin, you know, this month. Do you believe that in terms of looking at Octavia Butler's work, that there are things that will be coming to us, you know? And because I look at, there was a book that I read, the same way you were dealing with Octavia Butler. I read Profiles of the Future by Arthur C. Clarke. Mm-hmm. And he had this little pull-out thing in the back. It was like, I had this in 65. And right around like 2025, it says like extraterrestrial connection, you know, that we'd be seeing there. And so I'm waiting for that. So are there anything that you're waiting for?
I'm interested to see, are we going to be encountering, I'm really waiting for human beings to grow up. That's what I'm waiting for. As a child of the millennium, where's my flying car?
Okay, I know one American who should grow up, but I won't mention any names. Okay, Susanna Mars, I want to thank you for being my guest on The Margin. It's been a wonderful conversation. My guest today has been Susanna Mars. She's Associate Professor of Literature, Media, and Communication at Georgia Institute of Technology, and we've been talking about her fantastic new book, Positive Obsession, The Life and Times of Octavia E. Butler. The show's On the Margin. My name is Ethelbert Miller. The station's WPFW 89.3 FM.
University Department of Community and Family Medicine is hosting the Urban Health Initiative 5th Annual Peer Summit, Peers Reaching Out to Peers, this Saturday, October 11th, from 2 to 6 p.m. at Anacostia Park. This local forum will bring together DMV certified peer specialists, peer recovery coaches, healthcare leaders, and clinicians, all working on the front lines to fight the opiate epidemic and improve care coordination for our community. Details available at 202-250-5668. That's the Urban Health Initiative 5th Annual Peer Summit, Saturday, October 11th from 2 to 6 p.m. at Anacostia Park.
Brentwood Arts Exchange presents the Listening Room Series. The next concert is Friday, October 10th, 8 to 10 p.m. featuring singer-songwriters Ayanna Gregory and Free Benjamin with an evening of music filled with love, healing, and transformation. On November 7th, Sheikh Amala Jabate performs and Rose Morales on December 5th. Three nights of live music at the Brentwood Arts Exchange. Details via 301-277-2863. That's 301-277-2863, pgparks.com, or on social media at Gateway Arts Center.
WPFW is the media sponsor for the Institute for Policy Studies 49th Annual Letelier Moffitt Human Rights Awards on Thursday, October 9th at 5:30 p.m. Unsung human rights heroes will be celebrated in the memory of the victims of the Pinochet dictatorship and fallen colleagues Orlando Letelier and Ronnie Carpin Moffitt. This year's event takes place at the Friends Meeting House of Washington, D.C., and celebrates domestic awardees Detention Watch Network and Jeanette Vizguera, an international awardee, National Coordinating Roundtable of Organizations of Retirees and Pensioners of the Republic of Argentina, with musical performance by Navasha Dea. That's the 49th Annual Letelier Moffitt Human Rights Awards, 5:30 p.m., Thursday, October 9th, at Friends Meeting House of Washington, D.C., 2111 Decatur Place, Northwest. Details at ips-dc.org/lm49. That's ips-dc.org/lm49. WPFW, your station for jazz and justice, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
WPFW has offered inspiring music, poignant stories, and critical journalism for over 48 years. Whether reminiscing while hearing Nina Simone or learning about the harm done due to gross global inequity, WPFW has been the soundtrack for moments of revelation, joy, sadness, and resistance. It's your generosity that allows us to continue this tradition of expansive, emancipatory excellence in community radio. We ask you to once again be in solidarity with WPFW during our fall pledge drive by donating at WPFWFM.org and additionally from October 12th through the 25th at 800-222-9739. There is only one WPFW and only one you, the listener, who is committed to keeping independent music and message available to the people. Your generosity sustains and challenges us to build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
The DC Palestinian Film and Arts Festival is back this October with powerful Palestinian storytelling through live performance, films, and discussions with artists and activists, a culinary workshop, and a special children's program.